when I read the book, this is really, really compelling.
It is, because it's not between Jadis and Aslan. She makes it between his mother and Aslan.
Right.
You know, like the one where it really got me, he says, yeah, but I promised. But you didn't know what you were promising.
Yeah, that seems kind of fair.
That does seem kind of fair.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This
is Talking Beasts.
This is Glumpuddle.
And I'm Jim Fan.
And I'm Rillian.
We're talking about one of the most, I think, heart-wrenching scenes in the Chronicles of Narnia. I honestly forgot just how, this chapter is here.
I forgot about the witch's logic.
Yeah, where she really tries to convince him. But we're talking about chapter 13 of The Magician's Nephew, where Diggory goes to pick an apple that Aslan asked him to go get that's going to play an important part in protecting Narnia for some hundreds of years. And the witch says, hey, or plan B, you could just keep that apple for yourself, give it to your mother, and she'll be healed. And of course, in this chapter, we also see the origin of the White Witch being the White Witch.
The one thing that stands out to me, first of all, is just like the description of everything. I feel like there's so many things that are visual to set the scene. And then when you get to the parts where you are having a lot of dialogue and there's a lot of very heavy things that are being discussed and it's, you know, very serious, you still have it against this backdrop of this, you know, this beautiful place and this, you know, this adventure that they're going on.
Yeah, Lewis writes, it was a happy place, but very serious. This mysterious garden at the top of this hill with this giant hedge around it and all these trees inside it. And you're right, the tone of it is so important. I love how, you know, Fledge and Polly assumed they were going to go in too, but it's so immediately obvious that just the sense of privacy of the location. There's just this sense of deadly seriousness. But there's just this sense of reverence about the place that really sets a slightly ominous tone for the scene.
You know, if you go to a cathedral or a minster, a really, really old, beautiful church, and I've been to enough that, like, sometimes, like, you know, obviously there's lots of people inside, but it doesn't matter if there's a lot of people or if you're the only one. Everyone wants to be quiet. And you just feel so self-conscious.
It's not that it's a bad, scary place. It's just...
No, it's just you just feel so self-conscious. Like, that you just know, I'm not supposed to be loud here, or I'm not supposed to be drawing attention to myself. That's not the point of my being here.
And speaking of sound, which you've mentioned a few times throughout that motif, running throughout The Magician's Nephew, that's one of the things that's kind of notable about the space. I think it's how quiet it is. And in the Talking Beast Facebook group, Elizabeth wrote, it's intriguing that the garden is described as being very quiet, just like Charn was. Lewis in particular mentions the fountain in the garden being almost noiseless. And in Charn, the children found another fountain that was empty, dry, and silent. But the vibe of the garden is obviously completely different. So again, the sound or the absence of sound, super important thing that runs throughout The Magician's Nephew.
Even the gates are noiseless.
Oh, I forgot about that one. That's a good point. Then the inscription written on the door, come in by the gold gates or not at all. Take of my fruit for others or forbear. For those who steal or those who climb my wall shall find their heart's desire and find despair. Now, one of the things I love about Narnia, a lot of the Narnia books, probably Dawn Treader in particular, is the locations that have a instant suggested implied backstory. Probably the best example, the Coryocan's house. You're in the middle of nowhere in uncharted waters, and what do you find? A house, a normal house. It just, well, who lives here? And just, I love the sense of suggested backstory. But what's weird is this has that quality too, but it's a day old. Presumably Aslan sang this into existence along with Narnia. So presumably he wrote the inscription, I guess. And you just wonder, what is the purpose of the tree? Why did Aslan put it there? And it almost seems like it was tailor-made to test Diggory, honestly, the way the whole thing is set up. I'm not saying it is, but it kind of feels that way.
Well,
I mean, in some ways it's obvious. It's on the nose that, yes, it's kind of a recreation of the Garden of Eden story. But he has a very simple task, but he presents a moral choice. As opposed, it's almost like you're putting your child in a room And, you know, you're just like, you're trusting them to like, okay, well, here's, you can have fun in here, but this is the thing you can't do, as opposed to a completely sterilized environment where there's really nothing they could possibly do that would be wrong.
Right. There's a great bit from the chapter here. Lewis writes, as Diggory picks one of the apples and unfortunately decides to smell it. And Lewis writes, a terrible thirst and hunger came over him and a longing to taste that fruit. He put it hastily in his pocket, but there were plenty of others. Could it be wrong to taste one? After all, he thought, the notice on the gate might not have been exactly in order. It might have been only a piece of advice. And who cares about advice? I love that last bit.
It shows like how easy it is to like justify things in your head.
That's how I justify it. Well, no, I'll do exactly as he said. I'll take the one. But he didn't say, don't take a second one because there are others here. And is it really so bad? I mean, it is a tree. They are going to make more.
The sign on the door. I mean, the sign by the door does say, you know, only take for others.
Exactly. Right.
Which is what's interesting, though, is it says, take of my fruit for others or forbear. So
you can rationalize. Well, I'm not taking it from you. I'm taking it from my mother.
Yeah, but it's funny. It's funny that doesn't quite seem to come into his mind, though. To me, it's like, oh, I am taking it. Aslan asked me to get one, and I'll do that. But I'll also take one and give it to my mother, like the sign says. It's funny that he doesn't wrestle with that at all. I mean, it's funny you have that bird that's roosting there, or whatever it's doing, that's keeping an eye on him. I think Diggory, even if the exact words aren't there, he can kind of sense. No, I really shouldn't take anything here unless I've been given permission. But I do think it's interesting that he doesn't try to rationalize it that way. I'm just now thinking about this, actually. I mean, he says, you know, when the witch is trying to convince him, or take the apple, give it to your mother. You know, he says things like, mother herself wouldn't like it, awfully strict about keeping promises and all that sort of thing. She'd tell me not to do it.
Not stealing, which is also important.
But is it stealing? I mean, the sign on the door says, you know, take my fruit for others or forbear.
I mean, I think he is rationalizing, but I think to an extent he knows it would be stealing
because
he knows they're not his and he knows what Aslan asked him to do.
But when he saw the sign, why didn't he go, awesome, fruit for others. Great. That's what I want. I want some for my mother. Like, why wasn't that? I wonder why that wasn't his reaction. So as soon as I'm done delivering this to Aslan, I can go.
Well, maybe.
Because I think it was he knew that this is something. I think he understood this belongs to Aslan. Aslan sent him here.
Yeah.
Aslan's the only one who knows about it, as opposed to him just stumbling upon it, you know, absent any instruction.
And I think it's probably you rationalize it the same way that you rationalize, like, how did they know that only Diggory could go into the garden?
They just knew somehow.
They just knew.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think it's the same way with the tree and the apples. Mm-hmm. You just know.
Yeah. I mean, I can't argue with that because I'm literally just now thinking about, after having read the book several times, I'm just now thinking about this right now as we're recording. So obviously I, as a reader, just kind of knew as well.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. This is the moment. Really, I do want to ask really quick. I think we talked about this in the past episode, but the first time I read the book, and again, I read it in publication order, so this is book 6 for me. But the first time I read the book, this is the moment I realized, oh, this is the White Witch. Like, I just forgot her name was Jadis, I guess, because it only appears, I think, the one time in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in Maugrim's note. So the moment it says, you know, her face was deadly white, I was like, oh. She's the White Witch.
I think
this was actually the moment for me. I feel stupid now. But.
I think I'm trying to remember. It'd be interesting if I could query my younger self. But I think probably when they got to Narnia, I thought, oh, she's there now. She's in Narnia. She's going to be the witch. But I think this was one of the first times, even just this time reading it, reading this story. What a kind of scary, creepy thing it would be to have this beautiful, gorgeous woman whose face was just white. Like, I think I hadn't, like, and I think for the first time in my mind, I kind of thought almost like a corpse. Like, not, she's never described that way, but just the thought of having someone whose face was just white with no color in it is so disturbing to think about actually seeing.
Which is probably why they didn't follow Lewis's description in the movie with Tilda Swinton in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And they probably thought, you know, but that she has to be credible that she could tempt Edmonds. Maybe we want to. It's one thing to say it in a book, it's another thing to visualize it in the movie, which I can, even though it drove me nuts at the time, I can kind of acknowledge that.
It was, I understand. For that movie, but then I'm thinking, yeah, but if you're going to make the magician's nephew, you know, you lose that image.
Well, you could make her comparatively less pale throughout the movie and have it be a noticeable shift at the end.
Yeah, but then it's sort of like, oh, she's a brunette, now she's a white chick. I'm confused. Like,
I think there's ways.
Tilda was still quite pale throughout that movie. I think they could you know, darken her up for the rest of the. Most of the movie.
Or even, like, wasn't Tilda, like, they very purposefully made her look, like, not made up. Like, they made her look like she didn't have any makeup.
I think
makeup,
she didn't wear makeup.
Or she had no makeup on. So you almost go from.
Or at least she had makeup on that doesn't look like makeup.
Yeah, so you almost go from someone who has, like clearly is very done up to that kind of just gets stripped away. And that's also a way to very easily visualize, like, kind of, like, the waning of like that essence in her.
Yeah, I wonder if we have a similar kind of the one I just brought up with, you know, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, they're trying to make it credible that Edmund could be taken in. And I wonder, this is such a compelling choice here, Diggory faces. Do I take the apple, give it to my mother, or do I give it to the lion? And is it too easy if the witch looks like a corpse, like you said, really, and is like, come on, you know, it might feel like, you know, the Luke Skywalker's temptation in Return of the Jedi, which feels really empty to me when it's turn to the dark side. Like, he's not tempted at all. Look at this weirdo, this creepy guy. It's not tempting at all. Right? But when I read the book, this is really, really compelling. It'll be interesting to see how they handle that.
It is, because it's not between Jadis and Aslan. She makes it between his mother and Aslan. Her arguments are so compelling, especially if you think, well, wait a second. You know, like the one where it really got me, he says, yeah, but I promised. But you didn't know what you were promising.
Yeah, that seems kind of fair.
That does seem kind of fair. And it I think what Lewis is kind of doing here, it's, you know, so, he was very familiar, of course, with Socrates and Plato. And Socrates, one of his questions, famous questions, was, is it better to suffer evil or commit evil? And Socrates says, it is better to suffer evil than to commit it, because your soul, it changes your soul and damages your soul. And a lot of us might intuitively just say, okay, well, yeah, I mean, I should, you know, go hungry rather than steal some food. But if you really think about it at scale, it's a much more compelling question, because how many of us really would say, well, wait a minute, what if it's between dying of starvation or stealing a little bit of food? Like, a lot of us would say, well, I'd steal a little bit of food. Yeah. You know, like, if we're just being honest with ourselves, because we think, well, what if it's a genuine sin? It's an actual bad thing you're doing, but it's a small thing and it's a really bad thing. It's that kind of question where it's that situation where the question becomes much more interesting. And here because he's like, well, I mean, it's a lion I've never met. It's an apple. I'm not sure what he's going to do with it. It's a promise I didn't really understand. I didn't understand what the apples would do. I didn't understand the apple would help my mother, but now I do. And I am her son, and I've got an obligation to her. You know, you can see kind of the thought process.
He's been looking the whole book. I mean, for half of the book, maybe, I think, subconsciously. And then for the last few chapters, very consciously, he's been looking for the thing that might cure his mother. And here we are, found it.
But he's faced with that choice, because he knows there's this horrible, horrible thing that'll happen, he thinks, if he doesn't take it. But it's this small sin, this bad thing, this stealing that he knows his mother wouldn't like. But it's his conviction to that. He does actually hold it, and he doesn't do the wrong thing, because he's clearly faced with, it's an actual wrong thing.
Yeah, I see him as primarily remembering that moment he had with Aslan that we spent the entire previous episode talking about, where he looked up and Aslan was crying and said, I know grief is great. And it says at the end of the chapter, you know, when he remembered the face of the lion, he was confident that he had made the right choice. But this is the real climax of the story. This should be the moment when the climactic moment of the movie, when this is the choice Diggory's having to make. And this finally, 4 years later, gives me the opportunity to respond to an email I got from Cody 4 years ago when we started thinking about doing the Magician's Nephew episodes. We made it, literally 4 years. Like the pandemic had just started when I got this email.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think my son was born yet when I got this email.
My 4-year-old had just been born probably.
So Cody, thank you so much for your patience here. But he was sort of from a movie perspective, and I think it has relevance to how we kind of read the book as well. But kind of how do you sell Diggory's choice to the viewer? There's this choice of, do you obey Aslan and obey the sign at the entrance to the garden instead of trying to save his mother? And I think Cody was kind of asking basically, is it just, well, you know, Lewis was a Christian, Aslan's basically God, and of course we got to trust God, or does it work on its own level? I do think there's more to it than that. It really comes down to, in this moment, who do we trust, by extension Diggory, who do we trust, Aslan or the witch? Because what does the apple do? What will the apple do? The witch is painting this picture of your mother's going to eat the apple, she'll be able to sleep peacefully without drugs, it's going to be great, all that stuff. But of course, we'll find out later that that's not how it would have worked. That's not what would have happened. And I think audiences are wired to be suspicious of things that are too beautiful in fairy tales. The apple is a symbol in particular that we recognize. And of course, like we said, she's white. She looks like a corpse at this point. So I think it's not that hard of a sell for audiences to be like, oh, I believe that this is a difficult choice for Diggory, but I also know what the right choice is. I also know that he should not take the apple for himself.
He knows what the right choice is. It's just a question of whether he's willing to do the right thing.
Yeah, and you have to consider like the source. Like, we know that Jadis, up to this point, we know she's not a nice person. We know she's tried to be tricks, you know, like get her own way and manipulate, and we know she's not up to good things. So you should feel very hesitant about doing whatever she says.
And I think he understands this, right? But he is choosing between committing an evil or suffering. He doesn't have any illusions that he is choosing suffering. His mother is going to die. He is going to be without a mother. He has chosen the path of suffering. And it's only later we reveal it. I've never thought of it in terms of the Socrates question for some reason. But I do think that that's actually what Lewis was going for. Because he was very familiar with Socrates. It's a very famous part of Socrates' lore, for lack of a better word. But in that, Socrates, one of his big element of it was, no, it will harm your soul. It will corrupt your soul to choose evil. That changes who you are, and it damages your moral core. And it's interesting how that, I think Lewis plays with that theme later on.
Yeah, and one thing that's just now occurring to me is that, you know, throughout the book, you know, a couple times, both Uncle Andrew and the witch have said, you know, oh, but the rules that would apply to other people wouldn't apply to people like me. And this is Diggory choosing to follow something as basic as do not steal, rather than saying, oh, but there's this, what higher purpose could there be than saving his mother? You know, like Diggory is choosing in this moment to stay true to what he believes to be right, what his mother believes to be right. And it's not the first time that Diggory has been kind of taken in by how beautiful the witch makes something sound. There's that wonderful line earlier in the book where, you know, like, you know, the witch says pretty much what Uncle Andrew said. And Diggory thinks, you know, Uncle Andrew said the same thing, but they sounded much grander when Queen Jada said them, possibly mm-hmm. because Uncle Andrew was not 7 feet tall and dazzlingly beautiful. So it's not the first time that that happened. So this is a real moment of, there's been a couple times, and like, she was clearly doing something terrible, and Diggory's thinking, oh, isn't she great though? You
know, things like that are true. Things like that are true. I won't get into who it was because it's not important. It would derail the conversation. But I heard someone criticizing a certain guy who he would go on these public talks and lectures and stuff, and the guy said, what do you think of that guy? And he goes, oh, he's not that smart. He's really not. He goes, no, he has an English accent. He would never be successful as a lecturer without an English accent. He sounds more intelligent. If he had an American accent, it sounds more dumb. It's just funny how we do that with people.
Another thing I want to mention is, I think that might be relevant is, I think some character growth we're seeing in Diggory here that we've seen him behave very impulsively, very emotionally. And right here, he's saying no. Like when he hit the bell, it didn't make any sense. But, oh, I want to know what's going to happen. And, of course, jumping into the pool to begin with. We're seeing some growth here because he's recognizing how terrible it is that he's brought a witch into this world. He recognizes the seriousness of that. So I think the fact that he's in the right here, he's not just doing the emotional thing. He's doing what he actually believes to be right. Definitely shows some growth. I wonder how this scene plays in chronological order versus publication order, because to me, one of the, it's not the only thing, but I mean, when we're talking about Aslan here, does Diggory trust Aslan or not? In publication order, we're talking about a character I've known for 5 books. And I've seen that he's not safe, but he is good. I've seen that he does things like when he's invisible to some of them in Prince Caspian, that he's interested in the growth of the kids and he'll test them a little bit. And so I kind of go into the book knowing that. Whereas if you read this as book one and you don't know that, I wonder if maybe Diggory's choice seems like maybe it seems less plausible to you that Diggory would resist taking the apple to his mother. I wonder. Not sure if you remember Jim Phan from all the eons ago when you read the book as number one.
I would say that probably wasn't something that would have crossed my mind, because even though I hadn't read the books before, I was aware of Narnia. I was aware of the basic structure and I knew who Aslan was. So that probably doesn't make that helpful.
Which is most people. I think it's very few people that go into the books complete. Utter blank slate. But I wonder, theoretically, if this is really your first book, I wonder if you find Diggory's choice even more difficult in a way. If as book six, we're like, oh, obviously you trust Aslan, we know that. But I wonder if it's book one, maybe we're not so sure. I'd be very curious. In the comments, if you read this as book one and you didn't know as much about Narnia as Jim Phan did, you know, post a comment. I would love to know what your experience was. And of course, in the next chapter, we'll find out that Diggory made the right choice, or that Diggory and his mother would have gotten their heart's desire, but with it, despair. And we'll discuss that more in the next episode. But wow, this scene really, really, I've been reading it, just reading. I wasn't prepared for it, just to be really emotionally knocked out by it. Mm-hmm.
I found it very humbling, because I remember thinking, I feel like I probably would have stolen it. I mean, obviously, you hope you would do the right thing, right? But there's those moments you look at it, and if you're just being honest with yourself, you think, you know, it's at some point, it sounds presumptuous to read this and say, I would have definitely made the right decision.
What do you think the witch's end game is here? Why does she want Diggory to take the apple to his, which he finally deduces, by the way. He's like, hang on a second. Why do you care about my mother so much all of a sudden? But seriously, what does she gain by Diggory taking the apple to his mother? I guess she doesn't want the tree of protection to be planted. Does she know that that's what the apple would do? Maybe?
I'm not sure. I've wondered if she starts to figure out and it's out of spite.
Uh-huh.
You know, she doesn't want him to...
She hates Aslan.
We know that it would be, you know, spitting in the face of Aslan, trying to thwart him. But she did say that she knows what the plan is. He's taking an apple back to Aslan, so she can probably divine...
That's right. She does say that I overheard all your counsels last night or
so
whatever.
So she knows what Aslan asked him to do.
So she probably knows what this is, so...
Yeah, and would want... You know, it would be to her benefit, her great benefit, to not have Aslan have the apple.
So that's the emotional, really serious stuff. A couple other bits from this chapter I want to throw in there to get your guys' reaction. There's a bit here. What do you guys think this is? At the beginning of the chapter, Polly and Diggory both have a bath. And Lewis writes, when Diggory came back, Polly went down and had her bath. At least she said that's what she was doing, but we know she was not much of a swimmer, and perhaps it is best not to ask too many questions. Well, sorry, Jack, it's a podcast. We got to ask too many questions here. Jim Fan, what's your reading of that? Like, it's a meaningless throwaway thing, but what was going on there?
I assumed, given the context of, like, I don't know, I assume back then people made a big deal about, like, gotta make sure you're always clean or whatever. It's probably, like, a subtle, like, just be like, you know, she probably didn't actually get, like, take a whole bath because she didn't want to get in the water. So, you know, it's like making fun of it a little bit, like, you know, she didn't take her proper bath like she was supposed to and get all clean. She probably just, you know, washed her face a little and called it a day. Hmm.
But why her and not Diggory? I guess it's really from Diggory's point of view.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to embarrass her or whatever, be like, oh, you didn't actually clean yourself.
But why bother mentioning this, I guess? Why does Jack have this little half thought here? What does it do for the narrative or for the characters? Obviously, there's plenty of great stuff in the Chronicles that you don't absolutely need.
Because cleanliness is next to godliness.
Okay.
You know, it's like the thing.
Especially
it's
for
like
children in the late 1800s.
The thing is, you know, you ever read like Little House on the Prairie, and they always have their, you know, vast descriptions of, you know, how he's always got to, you know, make sure he washes behind his ears and takes his bath once a week, and it's a whole deal about, you know, you don't be dirty because dirty means you're a heathen or whatever.
Huh. So just a little detail that makes him seem a little more real, which Narnia's full of, I guess.
I think so, but I think it's also because this book is very much, do we ever leave Diggory?
No, we don't.
I'm
sorry, we do. Polly's punishment when they get back. They do briefly.
Polly's punishment, Uncle Andrew with the animals, but for the most part, like 90%, it's certainly Diggory. So I think it's kind of in his head, because she goes, well, I'm going to go down to the river too. And he's like, you don't swim. You're afraid of, you're not a good swimmer. You're afraid of, you know, your things. And we know she's a little more timid than he is.
The narrator is kind of in Diggory's headspace here a little bit.
That's kind of
I guess I always assume that it was
your
just
mind's in the gutter and you need to just drop this.
Sorry. I guess I just always assumed that it was like Polly was embarrassed about being naked or something, but I don't understand like why Lewis wanted to drop it here. And I don't know. It was one of those things I always thought, I don't really know what's going on here, but I'm sure if I ask one of these days, it's not the thing that jumps out at you about this chapter, so you quickly forget about it. But reading the chapter, and a couple people posted about it as well, asking that we talk about it. But reading the chapter was like, there's that little thing, and now I can finally get an answer to it. So thanks for trying, guys, at least.
I actually think I'll wait till we have a woman on the podcast, and I'll just ask her.
Sure.
There you go. I wondered. Apparently not. Thank you, Jim Fan.
No. I don't.
Or at least not that you're going to reveal to us anyway. Okay.
No, I will keep it to the grave.
I did one time. I had to go into the office. I think I was locking up or something. I think I was checking, like, you know, knock on the women's door, like, hello, anyone in there? We're locking up or something. And I like, there's like a couch in here. It's like wallpaper. It's like, holy moly. There's like books, a tea kettle. There's like a kitchenette, is a couch. And, you
whole
know,
secret society.
It's like,
it's like the office,
not,
you know, you go
not
in.
Not supposed
it's
to know about
different
this.
Room.
You're not supposed to spill the secrets.
Brilliant. Blurting it out on a podcast.
Come on.
Only other thing I want to mention is the chapter opens with the toffee tree, which is one of Lewis's coolest inventions. And what else might they have planted?
We'll find out in the next chapter, a couple of cool things were planted.
Yes. but really, and you mentioned pizza in the previous episode.
I did.
Like, but I had I kind of forgotten that it's like, it's not just toffee on a tree. It's fruit that reminds one of toffee.
It's like the leaves are like paper, and it's like, yeah.
But like, so what would
toffee-esque?
What would pizza fruit taste like, or what would?
Apparently, amazing.
Sounds pretty gross, but I don't doubt it would. It would be amazing. Another thing for the comments section: if you could plant anything, of course, Uncle Ernie wanted to plant railways and yada yada. But what would you plant? Not for just profit. But what would you plant that would just would be cool? I don't know.
Do we get original works if we plant a book? Like, if we get a book tree? Does it come out with, like, original works? Is it like an AI-generated work?
You know, do you plant a book and it'll grow up with a bunch of sequels or something?
Oh, there we go.
Oh, that's funny.
Plant the last battle, we get a dead book.
Plant the
afterwards.
Last battle. Probably
it's like
not.
You plant the book and then you get like all those like little golden books. It's like tiny like versions of them.
I mean, we don't know if I guess the way Uncle Andrew thinks could more or less work. I know that Aslan calls it a folly, but because the lamppost, that was just a piece of metal. So I guess you could replicate anything. Anyway, that's one of the most intriguing what if.
He does say like days.
Yeah.
He's like, Andrew, Uncle Andrew can't leave and come back and then just like have his little.
I wonder how long the you know, because the song is fresh in the air is the whole idea. I wonder how long.
He just says days.
That wears off. Does he say days? I don't remember if he says how long. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Pretty sure.
Anyway, all right, that's it. We made it through this. Woo! Made it through chapter 13 of Magician's Nephew.
Hey, the next chapter has some of the best dialogue in the series. So
tune in next time.
Be a good one.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Beast, the Narnia podcast. Visit narniaweb.com to join our community and stay up to date on the latest Narnia news. Please post a comment or question below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. You can also email us at glumpuddle@narniaweb.com, rillian@narniaweb.com, or jimfan@narniaweb.com. Special thanks to all of our Patreon supporters, especially our Knights of Narniaweb. Until next time, further up and further in.